Good morning. I'm from the state of Maine. Anyone been to Maine? Well, some of you are lucky. They tell this story up there, and if you'll permit me, I will tell it using the dialect that surrounded me when I grew up on the coast. Henry Treat, a farmer of 78, was the only person in Reverend Forbes' congregation one Sunday morning. The hymns sounded a bit thin, with only Henry and the Reverend singing. But the responsive reading didn't do too bad because Henry liked to shout the responses right out. When it come time to deliver the sermon, the Reverend Forbes leaned over and he asked Henry in a whisper if he should go ahead and deliver the sermon with only Henry there to hear it. Henry replied that when only one calf showed up at feeding time, he fed it. So the Reverend continued and delivered an inspiring sermon that lasted 2 hours. When the service was over, and Henry was shaking the Reverend's hand at the door, he confided to the Reverend that though he would feed just one calf, he wouldn't give it the whole load. We're going to cover a book today. That's a whole load. But I promise you that I won't keep you 2 hours. It's nice to be with you. And I hope our time spent together will be profitable as we consider some things from God's Word. One of the most difficult things that we face in life is the loss of hope. You can endure a lot of things as long as you feel like there is hope that at some point they will get better. But sometimes we reach a point where we don't have any hope. You give up hope that you're going to get better from this illness. You give up hope that the relationship that you have with your spouse is ever going to improve. You give up hope that your child who maybe has wandered away from the faith will ever return to the faith or not. You give up hope that maybe this thing that you're dealing with in your own personal life that you know is displeasing to the Lord, but it seems to have a grip on you, and you give up hope that you're going to be able to ever have any victory. You give up hope that you can never have a child, even though you have wanted a child. Some people give up hope of ever getting married, even though they always wanted to. And that loss of hope can be devastating. It can lead to lack of motivation. It can lead to sort of this attitude of giving up. It can lead to, in some cases, serious depression. And, of course, the worst of all is when a person actually takes their life because they've lost all hope. Well, this morning we're going to look at a short book in the Bible that's, I think, about that topic, at least somewhat. I'm sure it's got a lot more things in it, but we're going to look at it in terms of hope. Now, I'm not going to have you turn to this particular text, but in Romans chapter 15, Paul writes this: "For whatever was written in former days was written for our instruction, that through endurance and through the encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope." Now, when Paul writes through the encouragement of the Scriptures, we must remember that he's writing in the first century, and the only scriptures that Paul had available to him would have been the old, what we call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. The New Testament had not been compiled yet. He was beginning to write his letters, of course, but it's going to be a long time before all of his letters and then Peter's and John and the Gospels, etc., get assembled into what we call the New Testament. So when he says that through the encouragement of the Scriptures, he's talking about the Old Testament. So we're going to be looking today at a book in the Old Testament that gives us hope. So I invite you to turn to the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth. Now I want you to do something for me, if you would. I'd like you perhaps to put away notions of the book of Ruth primarily as a love story. We immediately think of Ruth as a love story because in our culture, romantic relationships have been the subject of all kinds of movies, and they are all kinds of they are the topic of many kinds of conversation, and we tend to romanticize the book of Ruth and read it through the lens of our own culture. And so we think this story is primarily about how Ruth and Boaz get together. I'm going to just suggest that maybe you package that idea and put it in a box somewhere and just put it away for a minute, okay? Let's see if we can hear this story the way the Jews would have heard it. Those ancient people, the covenant people of God, how would they have understood the book of Ruth as it was read to them? As they sat in the listening circle in the evening and the local priest or Levite would have read this book to them, how would they have responded to this book? We'll try to touch on that here and there. But I think I can pretty well guarantee that they would not have been looking at it through a romanticized type of lens that you and I may be tempted to approach the book. So we're going to look at it hopefully as the first readers would have heard it. So when we open the book, if you look right at the first chapter, it says, in the days when the judges ruled. This book sort of unfolds as a play. And you have this prologue, which tells us about the context. And then we're going to have five scenes in the play. And then it has a brief epilogue at the end. And that's how we're going to go through it. What's interesting about the book of Ruth is that it's one of the only books, might be the only book in the Old Testament, which does not deal with what we might call a famous type of person. There's no mention of a prophet. There's no mention of a king, except at the very end, because the story feeds into the line of David, of course. But the story itself is not about a king. It's not about a judge. It's not about, you know, someone like Joshua, who was the leader of Israel. It's not about any of those people. And almost all the other books of the Bible are about, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the patriarchs, and then Moses, and then Joshua, and then the judges, and then you get into the kings. And so you have Saul and David and Solomon, and then the rest of the kings, and then the prophets, right? And see, all the rest of the Old Testament, all the rest of the scriptures that Paul referred to in Romans 15 is about major folks. This book is not. Very ordinary story in many ways. And it's moved along by dialogue. You don't have the narrator, you know, giving long descriptions of this happened and then this happened. He gives little transitions and then he records basically conversations throughout the book that happen between people. And as we proceed, I want us to think about this subject of hope. Now, back to your text. It says, in the days when the judges ruled. Now, if you were in that listening circle and you heard that, that would have brought to mind all kinds of incidents. Apparently, the book was written after the time of the judges, because we know the book ends with the lineage of David. So now we're in the period of the kings. So the period of the kings followed the period of the judges. I hope you are familiar with your Old Testament storyline well enough. And the book of Judges, of course, occurs right before the book of Ruth. And if you know anything about the book of Judges, you know that this was not a good time. The book of Judges recounts a series of cycles, and the cycles keep going down and down and down until you reach the end of the book, and the author on two occasions, and I think he ends the book with this phrase, and there was no king in those days in Israel, and everyone did that which was right in his own eyes. And all you've got to do is read the book of Judges and see that that's what people were doing. Everyone was acting the way they thought they should act, and they were disregarding the covenant law that God had given. So you've got murder, and you've got tribal warfare, and you've got people setting up gods and false gods. It's just a mess. And so when the book starts out, he tells us right away, now in the days when the judges ruled, that little phrase right there tells the original hearers, oh, that time. Not a good time. Not like it was under the time of David, this may have been written during the reign of David, when he's trying to honor the Lord and he's trying to get the people to honor the Lord and he gets things ready to build the temple and he's writing psalms for the people and for the Levitical choir that will sing there at the tabernacle and at the temple. It's not like the time of King David. It's in the days when the judges ruled. So I'm not going to go through every detail because I'm assuming you're somewhat familiar with the story. But you know that in the days when the judges ruled, we have this man named Elimelech. And he is in Bethlehem, and there's a time of a famine. And he's married to Naomi. And they have two sons. And this famine hits, and they go to Moab. The author does not comment whether they should have gone to Moab or not, but I'm sure that raised a little bit of a stir in the original hearers, the Jewish people listening to this in Moab. Because you see, they knew the Old Testament storyline up to this point, and the Moabites figured in rather, well, not well in their history with Israel. But the author doesn't comment, and he quickly says they went down to Moab, they sojourned there for a while, and then Elimelech dies. And then the two sons die very quickly after that. You find that in verse 3. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. She was left with her two sons, and they got married, and they married Moabite women. And that would have caused quite a stir as well. Because, of course, they were not to intermarry with foreigners, for fear that foreigners would pollute the true worship of Yahweh. So that would have raised a little bit of a stir in this circle as well. Again, the author doesn't comment, he just reports it, but he says they both died, verse 5, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. And then she hears that in Moab, that the Lord had visited his people with food. The famine was over, and she was going to go back and try to reclaim her husband's land and see if she could make a go of it. But Naomi is in desperate straits, because to have no husband and no sons was a very precarious position to be in as a woman in the ancient Near East. There was no social security. There were no safety nets that the government provided for a widow. You were totally dependent upon your family. She was in a very difficult situation. So, that's the epilogue. That sets the story up. So, scene one is going to occur between Naomi and her two daughters-in-law as they consider going back. So I've called scene one, Hope Fading. Hope is fading. And so she says to them, verse 8. Now, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead," that would be their husbands, "and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." I want to draw your attention to the sentence, "May the Lord show kindness to you." The word kindness in Hebrew is a word that is very, very difficult to find a synonym in English. The word is hesed, H-E-S-E-D is how we would put it in English, hesed. And hesed is a word which tries to describe extraordinary commitment, extraordinary love, something that goes beyond the normal and the typical. She says, "May the Lord show kindness to you." She's asking that God would show to these two daughters-in-law great mercy, great love, great commitment, loyalty. It's all these words kind of compacted into this one word of hesed. It's a very rich word. In some translations, it's called loving kindness. And of course, the daughters-in-law, they protest. They say in verse 10, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Because if I could have another husband and have sons tonight, are you going to wait for them to grow up?" Right? Now look at the end of verse 13. She says, "It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me." That to me sounds like hope fading. When you think that even the Lord's hand is sort of against you in the circumstances of your life, you're losing hope. Now, what's amazing in the midst of this is that one daughter-in-law, she does go back. But, of course, we know that Ruth, she stays with Naomi, doesn't she? And she clings to her, and she makes this famous speech in verse 16, "Don't urge me to leave or turn back. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay." Incidentally, I always thought it was funny when they read this at weddings. I understand the sentiment. The words fit for a wedding, but it's actually a daughter-in-law saying this to her mother-in-law. But anyway, sometimes I have weird thoughts like that. It says, "I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." So when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. That is, urging her to go back. I'm just trying to imagine this scene, and someone had just said what Ruth said to me, what Ruth said to her. If someone said that to me, "Where you go, I'm going to go. Your people are going to be my people. Your God is going to be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be married. And may the Lord deal with me severely if I leave you alone." That's hesed, okay? That's commitment. That's loyalty. That's love. And Ruth puts it right there. That's the definition of hesed. And Naomi, in effect, if we can, you know, kind of see the scene unfold, she kind of looks at Ruth, and Ruth makes that great passionate speech and shows this great love for her, and she goes, "Oh, well." She doesn't seem moved by it, does she? That's scene one, hope fading. Scene two, they go back to Bethlehem. Starts around verse 19. And the whole town is excited. And verse 19, the women of the town see Naomi and they ask this question, "Can this be Naomi?" Now, there are two ways you can read that and come away with a whole different feel for what the scene, right? So imagine Naomi strolls into town, this little village, and all the women of the town see Naomi. She's been gone over 10 years. And they're so excited. And one way you can read this question is, can this be Naomi? Man, it's been 10 years. It's so good to see you. That's one way you can read that. Here's another way to read that. Can this be Naomi? In other words, the Naomi that they saw returning was not the Naomi that they saw leaving, because she had now lost a husband and two sons, and that lack of hope had had an effect on her, so she, almost as if her physical appearance had changed, she'd aged. Now, I don't know which way they said it. I just think it's interesting to imagine that scene. But I do know how Naomi responds. Would you look at that? Verse 20, don't call me Naomi, which means, you have a little study Bible there? Pleasant. Don't call me pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me pleasant? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. I went away full. The Lord has brought me back empty. Now remember, who's right next to her? Ruth. How would you feel if you were Ruth? What am I, chopped liver? You know. How would you feel if you were Ruth? And that comes right after that speech, right, of Ruth's commitment, her hesed to Naomi. She says, yeah, I went away full and I've come back empty. So this is scene two. And this is hope gone. Hope was fading, and now she comes back, and she's, what she says to these women tells us that her hope is gone. It's interesting that she attributes all of these events to the Lord, these bitter events. Now, there's a sermon right there. Naomi took her theology of God's sovereignty really seriously. She recognized that, I'll use a term my dad used to use all the time, vicissitudes of life. I love that word, vicissitudes. I can hear him now. Vicissitudes are the troubles and the agony and the difficulties of life, right? When the vicissitudes of life, when the tough things come along, Naomi said, ultimately, they are under God's sovereign plan. Can you swallow that theological pill? Remember Joseph and the troubles he went through, right? Sold into slavery and all that mess in Potiphar's house. And at the end of the book, he says what? You meant it to me for evil, but God meant it for... See, Joseph had a theology of God's sovereignty as well, and he recognizes that all that mess was ultimately under God's sovereign control. I think Naomi's theology was correct. Ultimately, God is in control of all things. I think her response to it was incorrect at this point. Fading and gone. Hope is fading. Hope is gone. That's scene two. Scene three. Hope is stirring. Now, I got to go quickly. So I'm just going to kind of, you know, ram some things together here. So we know what happens. The author tells us that when they return, it's around barley harvest season. And so Ruth, who is a foreigner and a widow, which gave her the right to go out into the fields and glean. According to the Old Testament law, you could go out and glean in the fields if you were a widow or a foreigner because you had no means of income. So she goes out and she just happens to fall upon Boaz's field, and there she gleans. And we know the story there. Boaz comes out during the middle of the day. He's overseeing his workforce. He sees Naomi and he, you know, asks his foreman about her, and he takes special note of her and offers her hesed. He does some things that are out of the ordinary. He says, you know, when you're gleaning, I want you to drop a few extra sheaves in her way. When it came to eat lunch, Boaz invited her to the workers' table and gave her to eat from his own larder, so to speak, and also sent her home with quite a bit of food. What's Boaz doing for Ruth? He's being extraordinary. We aren't told about his motivation. See, we want to romanticize that scene, and we see, you know, we have it in the big movie screen, and Boaz is riding up on his horse, and he sees Ruth out there, and she's golden brown from being in the sun, and, you know, he lights off his horse, and you almost can see them start in slow motion to dance toward one another. No, it's not. That's not the way it happened. But we want to romanticize this and think he was physically attracted to her, so he starts giving her all this neat attention. He knows who she is. Small town, Bethlehem. He would have known Naomi has returned. He might not have known who Ruth was right away, but the foreman points her out. But at the end of chapter 2, verse 19, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So Ruth told her, she said, "I worked at a guy's field named Boaz." "Yahweh bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." The word kindness there is what? Yeah. "Yahweh has not stopped showing his hesed to the living and the dead. That man is our close relative, and he is a kinsman redeemer." And Ruth said, "He even said, stay with my workers until we finish." In other words, you don't need to go to any other fields. You can just stay here. And Naomi said, "Well, that's smart. You might be harmed in someone else's field." Why might she be harmed in someone else's field? Because it's the days of the what? The judges. It's not safe. And so Ruth did, and she stayed there until the end of harvest. Hope is stirring. The Lord has not stopped. See how Naomi moves through this narrative? She starts out full. She becomes empty. She becomes despairing. She lacks hope. And then her daughter-in-law, who shows her great love and compassion, goes out and works for them in order to bring them food, and it just so happens that she lands on Boaz's field. And Naomi, rightfully, also says, "Well, the Lord maybe hasn't stopped showing his loving kindness." She didn't get her husband back, she didn't get her two sons back, but there's a smattering of hope. Scene 4 is the threshing floor, and you and I know what happened there on the threshing floor. It's where Ruth proposes to Boaz. Here we have hope increasing. Again, I'm going to compact this. Naomi says, you know, get down there. This is a little plan, and maybe we can get Boaz to do what we want him to do, which is be a kinsman redeemer. So Ruth goes down to the threshing floor. Something wakes Boaz up in the middle of the night. We're not told what. And he sees Ruth lying at his feet. And she says, spread your garment over me. Now that word is the same word that is used in chapter 2, where Boaz says to Ruth, let's see if I can find it. Yes, in verse 12, Boaz says to Ruth, may the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by Yahweh, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Now that word, wings, is the same word that is used in chapter 3 for garment. So in chapter 2, Boaz has a prayer for Ruth. And the prayer is, may you be richly rewarded by God under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And now Ruth says to Boaz, you are going to be the means of God doing that. Uses the same word. Boaz, I want to come under your wing. And in that way, Yahweh will richly reward me. That's really what's happening. And Boaz says, I'll do it. Now, you've all heard about the kinsman redeemer responsibility. Ruth didn't have a husband. Naomi didn't have a husband. So it was the responsibility of a relative to be their rescuer. And in this case, to rescue them would be for Boaz to marry, and that way Elimelech's land would then pass into Boaz's family, and he was a man of means, and he would be able to support them both. Hope is increasing. Now, we all know there's a little snag in the problem. There's a closer relative, right? Well, when we get to scene 5, the last scene, we have hope restored. Because in scene 5, Boaz, showing hesed, goes to the town gate, says, I want to redeem. And this guy says, well, I have first dibs. There was a closer relative. And so Boaz says, well, know that if you take up that responsibility, you're also going to have to marry Ruth. And I won't get into the finances of it, but this guy couldn't afford it. And so once he hears that, he backs off and says, well, then I can't do that. And Boaz says, well, I'll do it. So he legally gets the right to redeem. And he redeems and he marries Ruth. And of course, we know there's going to be a son born from their union. And look at the last chapter because it's so interesting. Verse 14, remember we had the women saying to Naomi, can this be Naomi? Remember that in chapter 2 or chapter 1? The women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. I love this. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth. Remember when Naomi, after Ruth's profession of commitment to Naomi, Naomi seemed to, you know, ignore it. And she says to the women of the town, I came back empty. It's like the women tell Naomi, Naomi, this is how you should really assess your daughter-in-law. She is better than seven sons. And of course, Naomi is overjoyed. Hope for Naomi is restored. So what's this story all about? How does this help us with hope? I'm going to give you a couple of things to think about and we'll be done, okay? We can have hope because this story teaches us that God never abandons his people. He never abandons a child of his. Now, some of you are in the first scene and second scene with Naomi, and you think the Lord's hand has gone out against you. You have bitter pills that you are having to swallow, and you find it very, very challenging. And you are in danger of losing hope and becoming bitter against the Lord. How did God respond to Naomi? Did he say, well, if you're going to be that way, then I'm just out of here. If you're going to be bitter against me, I'm just fooey with you. No. He gives her hope. Gives her hope through a daughter-in-law and then through Boaz. And he slowly works with Naomi so that Naomi, although she says in chapter 1 she came back empty, the women of her town, the women of the town say she came, she now is full. The book of Ruth is about Naomi going from empty to full. No hope to full of hope. You can have hope because God never abandons his children. And maybe you're in this scene right now, and I just encourage you, don't give up hope. Continue to trust in God, even when it makes no sense, and even when you don't see any way out of it, trust in God. You may not get the answer you're looking for, but God does not leave you. Second thing we learn from the book is that we can have hope because God rewards a life of chesed. We saw this with Ruth. Ruth just gives all kinds of love and tenderness and commitment and loyalty to Naomi, even when Naomi seems to not have cared. But she sticks with her. The easy thing for her would have been go back to Moab with her people. Instead, she's going to a foreign country. Now, I didn't get to rehearse this with you, but the Moabites were not looked upon favorably by the Israelites. You know how the Moabites got started? Lot had an incestuous relationship with his two daughters, and one of those sons becomes the father of the Moabites. Not a great beginning. The Moabites refused to give Israel bread when they were coming out of Egypt and on their way up to the promised land. They said, we will buy the bread, we just want to pass peacefully through and buy bread from you. And they would not. They would not give it to them. And then later in the book of Numbers, it is the king of Moab who hires a false prophet to come and curse Israel. You remember that story? And all he could do was bless because God wouldn't let him curse. But yet, what did the king of Moab want to do? He wanted to curse them. Do you think the Israelites forgot that? And then at one point in their story, the Moabite women came into the tent, the tents of Israel, and seduced some of the men. And they were now committing idolatry. I mean, you just got a mess. So that the law says in Deuteronomy 23 that no generation of Moabites will ever enter the temple. They were forbidden from the temple. And yet the author keeps reminding us it's Ruth the Moabitess. Ruth the Moabitess. And she is leaving her town, her home, and going to this place where the people don't like Moabites. That's a lot of history to have to live down. And yet she demonstrates chesed. And we can have hope because God rewards us in ways sometimes we may not understand. But he rewards us when we demonstrate that kind of loyalty and commitment to other people. And there are people in your life who are Naomi's that you need to demonstrate that commitment to right now. There are people like Naomi who are in scene one or two, and they don't really want you. Or at least they don't seem that interested in what you have to offer them, and they need you right now to still love and still care for and still be committed to. Do you have that kind of persistence? Will you be committed to someone who doesn't seem to be all that committed to you? How is she rewarded? She gets to be in the line of Christ. She's in the line of King David, as the last few verses tell us in the book. And of course, we know from the Gospel of Matthew that she's also in the line of Christ. God rewards people who live a life of extraordinary commitment and care for other people. Number four, we can have hope because God is always working, even though... I'm sorry, I skipped number three. We can have hope because God always has people of genuine faith in times of cultural decay. Do you ever feel all alone here in America? Or at your job or at your school? You ever feel like you're kind of like Elijah? I'm the only one who has not bowed the knee to Baal, you know? And you just feel so depressed because everything around us seems to be crumbling from our government to the entertainment industry. Just everything just seems to be just foul and nasty and unkind. It's cultural decay from a moral perspective. God always has people during times of moral decay and cultural decay who are faithful. In the book of Judges, who was it? Boaz. Boaz opens up his field to foreigners like as he should. Treated them well. Follows the law and everything in the book. Does it by the book. See, how did genuine faith last during the time of the judges? When you read the book of the Judges, you think there isn't anybody in Israel who's a person of faith anymore. This whole place looks, you know, like it's just gone off the map spiritually. And then we read Ruth. How does genuine faith survive so that a David can come along? Because David had some in his family line who were faithful. God always has people. Even when they don't seem to be many, during times of decay, God always has people that are faithful to Him. You can have hope for that. No matter what happens, God's church will remain. People of faith will remain. Number four, and I'm going to have to wrap up because I'm running long. We can have hope because God is always working, even though it is behind the scenes. God is working in your situation right now, and you have no clue what He's doing. When Ruth goes out and just happens to get on the field of Boaz, does she know what she's doing? Does she know this is Boaz's field? Nope, she's just doing what? She's doing what she's allowed to do. She's allowed to glean. Here's a field. I'm going to glean. God knows whose field it is. Boaz just happens to wake up in the middle of the night. What if he hadn't? You see, in the book of Ruth, who's at work? God's at work. Naomi had given up in scene 1 and 2 that God was working at all. His hand is, he was working, but he was working against me, right? No. He's working. He's moving things around. We can have hope that God works all things together for our good, right? We quote Romans 8:28. We have hope, you see. I'm so glad I worship a God who isn't capricious. He's not random. He's not up there wringing His holy hands and figuring out what to do next. I can rest. And last of all, we can have hope because God is gracious to the most unlikely of people. Ruth was a very unlikely person for anyone to ever be gracious to. She came from a people who were despised, did not treat God's people well. They were forbidden from going into the temple. And yet, what does God do? He brings her into the line of Christ. And you and I are all Ruths. We're all Ruths. We are all unfit to enter into the kingdom of God. But Jesus makes us fit. Because God is a God of hesed himself, isn't he? He's a God of extraordinary love and extraordinary commitment and extraordinary tenacious, persistent care. And he said, I'm going to rescue people who desperately need rescuing, and they don't even know it. And so Jesus leaves his hometown, he leaves heaven, and he comes to a foreign place. He comes to the earth, and he takes upon our sin, and he dies on the cross as he does that and rises from the dead victorious. And he does that because he wants to demonstrate his hesed to sinners. So, have you embraced that love and loyalty of Jesus? I hope you have. Let's pray. Father, the book of Ruth, we've touched on just a few things. May we have hope today as we look at our life. We look at the difficulties of it. May our hope be restored. Why is our soul cast down? The psalmist reminds us. We should hope in God. So may we hope in you for our salvation and for working out all the troubles of life, eventually for our good, our maturity, and your glory. Thank you for that promise. Amen.